The human eye is composed of many parts that work together. We receive visual images, focus them properly, and send the message to the brain via the optic nerve. Light rays bounce off the object or the person that we're seeing, and each eye sees a slightly different picture. The brain then receives the image, combines them, and turns them into a single picture. But what are the chances that something can go wrong? And how likely is it that as we age, we will lose our eyesight? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. We don't often discuss surgical procedures on this show, but today's guest is a surgeon, and she often performs the procedure we're about to see. I need to warn you that the surgical video is very graphic. It's not recommended for young children, and some viewers may find it disturbing. It's by Dr. Sydney Tyson of Eye Associates, New Jersey. Remember, his patient is under anesthesia and so is feeling no pain or other sensation.
Hello, this is Dr. Sydney Tyson of Eye Associates, and I'd like to share with you this 5-minute video on cataract surgery, and kind of share with you how we do it and try and take some of the fear out of cataract surgery. We initially make a little incision in the cornea, which you can see is blood-free, and inject a small amount of anesthetic to numb the eye. There are no needles used in this procedure. We then make the initial incision, again without any blood, and it's about 3 millimeters in length, very small. We add a lubricant to the inside of the eye to protect the cornea, and then we gently peel back the front surface of the lens. The lens is like a grape, where there's a skin and pulp. We're removing the outer skin to allow access to the pulp inside. We loosen up that pulp, which is the actual cataract you can see moving with this fluid as we irrigate it throughout the lens material. We then use an ultrasound instrument to break up the cataract. This instrument vibrates approximately 50,000 times per second and does a wonderful job of disassembling these brittle lenses in many cases. As you'll note, there are no lasers used for cataract removal. That's a common misconception. So what this device does, as you can see, it slowly but surely removes all the lens material. This cataract that had been formed is slowly going away with these little bites. This is absolutely pain-free. And you can see that dark brown material start to disappear. There's a high suction that's associated with this device, which then removes these pieces as they're broken up. And you can see the lens slowly disappear. This is what we would consider to be a moderate to fairly dense lens. So the majority of the pulp of the grape or the lens is gone.
And that's the part that was obstructing vision. But there's another stage to this procedure which we'll see in the next segment. Plus, we have a great guest to help us maintain good vision. We'll plan the menu for a healthy meal and get a good workout with Sean. But now it's time for the news. Thank you. In the headlines today, vitamin C and statins alter cataract risk, weight loss benefits atrial fibrillation, and heart failure risk rises with fried foods. A recent meta-analysis has found that higher vitamin C intake and blood levels appear to decrease the incidence of cataracts, while another study shows that statins increase it. Researchers in China analysed 30 studies of both Americans and Asians and found that people with the highest vitamin C levels were 30% less likely to have cataracts, while a case-control study involving 800,000 Canadians found that those taking statins for 1 year or more had a 30% higher risk of undergoing cataract surgery compared with those who were not. So eat oranges, red bell peppers and veggies for vitamin C, grains and nuts for cholesterol, and stay away from those saturated fats. Then you may not need a statin. Weight loss and the management of cardiometabolic risk convey significant advantage in obese and overweight patients with atrial fibrillation or AF. A new study from Sydney, Australia, randomised obese AF patients to weight loss or normal care and then followed them for a year. The weight loss group lost on average 15 kilos or 33 pounds. Their heart scans showed significant reduction in the fat around the heart, lower heart muscle mass, and less volume in both right and left atria. Since left atrial enlargement is strongly associated with AF, weight loss is a great way to relieve the burden of atrial fibrillation. Fried food may increase the risk of heart failure in proportion to how often we eat it. This is a new finding from the Physician's Heart Study, which followed 15,000 male doctors for 10 years from the average age of 66. At the start of the study, those eating fried food 1 to 3 times a week were 18% more likely to develop heart failure. Eat it 7 times a week and you're 68% more likely to develop heart failure, which is debilitating, depressing, and deadly. So why not switch those fries, donuts and chicken for greens, beans and berries? I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben and that's today's health news. On today's show, we're joined by Dr. Natasha Hertz, an ophthalmologist working at Washington Adventist Hospital in Maryland. When it comes to caring for your eyes, it can be confusing to know who you should see for what services. Should it be an optician, an optometrist or an ophthalmologist? Here's Dr. Hertz to explain the differences in training and the services that each provide.
We call them the three big O's, and often it's interchanged all the time and people really don't know what they mean. So an optician is somebody who makes the glasses. An optometrist is a doctor of optometry or an OD, and they go to 4 years of optometry school after college, and they do glasses and contacts, and they do learn about screening for eye diseases, but they do not do surgery. They do not, some of them do treat some of the medical eye diseases. An ophthalmologist, though, goes to 4 years of medical school after college, followed by a 4-year surgical residency, and then oftentimes another 1 or 2 years of fellowship. And they are trained then to treat medical diseases of the eye and to do surgery.
Now, as you're an ophthalmologist, yes. So you are an MD first and then you've done your eye training.
Yes.
So what are the most common conditions that you see?
So usually the people that end up having eye disease are older. There are some young people that can have some eye problems, but medical eye problems, but it's mostly an aging problem, and the incidence of those things increase after 50.
So you're saying that from 50 we should be seeing someone like you regularly, or?
That's the recommendation. So if there is any systemic disease, such as diabetes or hypertension or a rheumatologic disorder, because young people can get those too, then it's recommended to see an ophthalmologist. And then for people that are 50 and older, because the incidence of age-related eye disease, such as cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration, those all increase for every year you are past 50. And so for those groups of people, we do recommend at least one screening per year, complete dilated eye exam by an ophthalmologist. And then if any eye disease is found, you'll be seen more often.
Mm. So an ophthalmologist rather than an optometrist?
Right.
Okay. After the break, we've got something a little different in the kitchen. But first, this.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm mulching these vegetables. They're organic, you know.
Oh, that's a really good idea because all the vegetables in the market are full of pesticides, aren't they?
So is that fish you're eating.
What?
Yeah.
No way. We all know that the biggest concern with pesticides is with vegetables and fruits, not with fish.
Oh, really? You've never heard of biomagnification?
Biomagnificent?
Biomagnification. You know, the big fish eat lots of little fish, which eat tons of phytoplankton plants living in pesticide-contaminated waters. And so as you go up the food chain, the concentration of pesticide gets magnified up to 10,000 times.
Oh, and I'm eating it?
Uh-huh. Happens with most meat.
Oh, no. So this is a chemical warehouse?
That's right.
So I should have ordered that phytoplankton burger instead.
Go vegetarian. Reduce your pesticides, herbicides, toxic chemicals, and your heavy metals. Doctor's orders.
And we're back. We're not cooking in the kitchen today. We're going to do some menu planning. Now, the hardest thing for me is to figure out what I'm going to have for dinner. So I'll go to the fridge and I'll have a look around and say, well, what do I feel like or what's there? And one thing to bear in mind is focus on colour. Think about the colour. So if we look at this plate of food that we've got here, what I want you to notice is we've got some protein over here. We've got some carbohydrate, and then we've chosen vegetables that have high colour. So green, orange, yellow, and the deep red. A little extra carbohydrate there. So when you're planning your meals, think about the colours of the rainbow. The closer you can get to the colours of the rainbow, the better it is. And I don't mean red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple. Just think of lots of different colours, all right? Because we know that the colours are the phytochemicals that are in these plants, and that's what's going to be so important for our ongoing health. Let's start with fruit. You know, we come here, we've got some beautiful strawberries, beautiful blueberries. You can see how much colour is here. Berries are one of the top antioxidant fruits that there are. So you can't go wrong with these. Strawberries have lots of vitamin C, as do blueberries, but they've also got those luteins, the xanthines, good for the eyes, really helpful. You'll notice that the fruits that we have in the summer, like the pears, the apples, the bananas, they don't have a lot of colour inside them. Their colour is on the outside. Of course, bananas, you're not going to eat the skin, but these, don't take the skin off. Eat the skin, because that's where those colours are. Inside, it's white. You notice in the winter, we have all these highly coloured foods like the beautiful persimmon or the orange, the grapefruit. And I think that's because we need a few extra antioxidants and a few extra of those phytochemicals in the wintertime when we're struggling with those intercurrent illnesses, those viruses and things. You know, I love opening a cantaloupe or a papaya, because the colour inside is just magnificent. So let's see what we find in here. Oh, look at that. It's just such a delight to eat this for breakfast. Wow. Now, if you're choosing a carbohydrate, you have the option of white potatoes, or you can go for coloured potatoes, and they're going to have so much more goodness in them. It's still going to have fibre, they're lower glycemic index, they've got the extra colour, so think about those instead of potatoes if you can afford it. And of course you can also go for the butternut squash, which you can see plated on our meal today. That lovely orange, that's going to give you the carbohydrate with the colour, so there's an advantage there. When it comes to your cucumbers, don't take the colour off. I know it's always tempting to take the skin off. If it's a really tough skin, just take half the skin off. I just peel it in stripes, so I get at least half the skin, even if it's a little bit tough. Sweet red bell peppers, beautiful, full of vitamins, great foods. Now, when you're cooking, don't forget, you can add colour. You know, this is the cheats way to get some colour in. Turmeric, very powerful antioxidant. Good for the heart, good for the blood vessels, good for the eyes, and good for cancer. And this is paprika, so you can see how much colour you can add. And there's probably, I'm guessing, some turmeric in that plated meal today. Now, when it comes to the leafy greens, you can't go wrong. Look how much green is in here. This is chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is so important for good health. So get your greens, get your leafy greens. Your celery's got lovely aromatic flavour. Your lettuces, this is a radicchio. You can see it's got beautiful colour there. Of course, your carrots, and your carrots also come with greens on the top. You don't have to throw them away. This is very edible. Now, when you're doing your beets, please don't throw the beet leaves away, because beet leaves and beet stalks have got lots of colour in. And if you take a beet leaf and chop up the stalk all the way up to the leaf, keep chopping, do your leaves, just like you would spinach or any other greens, you'll be surprised how much colour comes out in your water. So there you have it, folks. Cooking by colour. In the first segment, we watched Dr. Sydney Tyson of Eye Associates New Jersey complete the first stage of cataract surgery. He's removed most of the cloudy lens. I need to warn you that the video you're about to see is graphic and it's not recommended for young children. Some viewers may find it disturbing.
We use then a secondary device called an irrigation aspiration device to remove remnants or fibers of lens material that are left over. And we're very careful to remove as much of this material as possible. And what's left after all this material is gone is a sac, which we call the capsular bag. And now within this sac, we're going to place some more lubricant in order to expand the sac to allow for the placement of the intraocular lens. This lens goes through the same incision, approximately 3 millimeters, is foldable, and is gently inserted into the capsular bag to replace the lens that was previously removed. This restores focusing power. Many people ask, do I need to have an intraocular lens placed? And the answer is yes. Otherwise, everyone would end up with thick cataract glasses or contact lenses after cataract surgery, and that's outdated at this point. These lenses restore focus in the monofocal variety. It is good only for distance, and most people need glasses afterwards. But now with the advent of modern technology, we have multifocal lenses which allow great vision at distance, intermediate, and near. We close the wound simply with a salt solution. You can see that there are no stitches required. And that is cataract surgery. Very simple.
Simple and straightforward to today's guest, who has a lot of experience with cataract surgery. Dr. Natasha Hertz is an ophthalmologist who practices here in Maryland. We see cataracts in the eyes of our cats and dogs, and if we live long enough, we will all get cataracts too. So it's good for us to know just what a cataract is. So here's Dr. Hertz to explain.
A cataract is when the lens inside the eye starts to get a little cloudy, which is mostly an aging change of the lens. And if you think of the eye like a camera, the lens sits behind the pupil in the eye and it focuses the image and the light that comes through the pupil onto the retina. So it's the main focusing part of the eye.
Okay. And what happens when there's a cataract?
So cataracts most typically start somewhere in your early to mid-50s, which at that point it's a very mild haze that has developed in the lens. And gradually then develops over time. Usually it can be 20 to 30 years before it's fully developed and cloudy enough to impair the vision.
And why do you get that cloud? What causes it?
So it is mostly an aging change of the lens, but there are other things that can make cataracts form, and some of them make them form more quickly than others. But number one risk factor being age, number two, smoking. Number three, and maybe not necessarily in this order after that, but systemic disease such as diabetes can make them form faster. And medicines like steroids make them grow faster. And the most potent cataract formation is caused by steroid eye drops, but also steroid pills like prednisone or inhaled ones or even topical ones. But that is the least common to get it from a topical steroid. They have to be applied directly near the eye for that to increase cataract formation.
So those are the things that would make it more rapid. Is there anything we can do to slow its progression?
So that's a good question. A lot of people ask me that. I didn't mention with my list before, but UV exposure over your lifetime does make a difference, because if somebody has worked outdoors, I will see their cataracts form much earlier than the average person. But wearing then glasses with UV protection in them, UVA, UVB, as well as then eating a lot of green leafy vegetables, that a lot of antioxidants, because that helps against to combat aging changes. But it does really help to decrease the rate of cataract formation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the maturation of the cataract, that it takes time. Is there a best time to treat cataracts? Do you usually wait for a while? How do you tell when it's time to treat?
So the classic question is always, when is my cataract ripe? You know, when's it ready to take out? And the answer is that there is a long maturation period often, you don't do anything for them other than, you know, trying to stay healthy otherwise, eat your green leafy vegetables and wear your UV protection. And there's no medical treatment otherwise, but when they are cloudy enough that they impair your vision and keep you from being able to see well enough to read, well enough to drive, in spite of the best glasses we can give you, then it's time to take them out. And typically, the average American is 75 when that happens. And when I give a cataract rating as far as like how cloudy it is, I'll say it's about a 3 out of 4, that kind of clouding rate. And that's typically at the point where it's making their vision 20/30 or worse.
Mm. And that's when you'd be saying it's time to operate. Why do you wait that long?
Well, because there is a long period of time where cataracts don't affect the vision at all. And so first, do no harm. So it's not where, even though the cataract surgery is very successful, it's the most successful procedure in the United States done. It's done, most commonly done as procedure as well as very successful. There's less than a 1% risk of a complication such as infection or some kind of instance where some of the cataract got left behind. So it's a very successful procedure, and people usually see well enough to drive even the next day after the procedure. So
amazing.
But you don't do it unless it's really impairing the vision.
Right. So just because of those risks, you'd always wait and have a really good reason for doing it. So I want to know, we're watching this video of cataract surgery. How do you keep your hands so still?
Well, you know, some of that, I suppose, has to just be natural. But there's some tricks.
Really? Okay.
But you do have to be relaxed when you do it, because it does, if you're tense, it makes you shake. And then there's some ways of just positioning yourself to keep from shaking.
Well, it's just amazing to watch. Now tell us, we're about to see the lens put in. So you take the kind of the broken lens out and you replace it with an implant. How do you decide? Do implants come in different shapes and sizes? How do you decide what you're going to use to replace a person's lens?
Well, so we measure everybody's eye a couple of weeks prior to the surgery for the right power of lens implant to put in. And that's because we have the opportunity, when we are replacing your lens, to also correct for nearsighted or farsightedness or even astigmatism. And there's some implants, they call them premium lens implants, but that also have computer and reading prescription built into them. And I brought some examples. Now, these are about 10 times at least bigger than what really goes in your eye, so don't get too concerned about it. But that's what a standard implant looks like. It's made out of a foldable acrylic material so that it can be folded sort of into a little taco shape and then inserted through a small incision, like 2 millimeters in size, and then through the pupil. And then once it gets back behind the pupil, it opens up And the same structures that held your natural lens in place will hold the new implant in place. And this was an example of the premium lens that has both the distance as well as computer and reading built into it. And you can see there's concentric rings of power in that central optic as opposed to just one set, one power throughout the monofocal lens there.
And so this would mean that when you get your cataracts done, you also can throw away your reading glasses.
If you were a good candidate for this, you would be able to do almost every task without your glasses.
So that's fantastic. Well, that's good news about aging, isn't it?
That's true. I do try to reassure my patients. It sounds scary to have your eye operated on. However, there are some wonderful things that I can do for you once it's time. Mm. And sometimes once they get a hold of the fact that they could get rid of their reading glasses, then they're begging me to take their cataracts out even when they're not ready.
Excuse the pun, but I can see both sides of that debate. Be ready to work out with us right after the break, but first, this. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul says that the God of this world has blinded the minds of those who don't believe, so they are unable to see the glorious light of the good news of Christ. He knew what he was talking about because he'd been blindly killing Christians before Jesus revealed himself on the Damascus Road in dazzling brightness. So bright that Paul was unable to see a thing for the next 3 days. So he sat in the darkness thinking about his life and the prophecies and scripture that he'd studied, and it dawned on him that Jesus Christ was everything he claimed to be. It was a crushing realization to discover that he had been completely and utterly wrong, blind. Rather than a political activist, he was actually a murderer, and rather than a Hebrew scholar, his understanding had been terribly flawed. Rather than being in the news, he now accepted the good news of Jesus Christ. God miraculously restored Paul's eyesight, yet at the end of 2 Corinthians 4, he says, "We fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen, for the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things we cannot see will last forever." Is your gaze fixed on things that will last forever? We're back. It's time to get out of that comfortable chair and get moving with Sean.
How are
Hi,
you?
Sean.
Good. So look at that.
Yeah.
Just one lonely weight.
And it looks like it's ready for action.
It is.
Yeah.
Let's get warmed up first.
Okay.
All right, we're going to start with some jumping jacks, all right? But these are going to be low jacks, all right? So you literally come here, get nice and low. So you see my feet? I'm sinking into it. You keep going. Working the delt, working the quads, working the glute. All right, give me one more. One more. Perfect.
And working the heart.
That and the heart, absolutely. One of the great exercises that you can do is plyometrics. It's jumping, all right? Jumping allows you to burn some calories, get warmed up, prepares you for your exercise.
And it keeps you agile.
It does.
If you don't do any jumping, you tend to get a bit clumpy.
Absolutely. Mm. Especially if you're at a desk job all day, you need some movement, right?
Right.
So this is a kettlebell. We've used it before. And I'm going to show you how to burn a lot of calories with one weight, okay? We're going to start with the swing, okay? The weight is going to be here, okay? And I'm going to give it to you, actually.
Okay.
Because you love to work. All right? So what I want you to do is you go back first and then come up. Yes. Perfect. This is a kettlebell swing. It works the entire body. If you're looking to burn calories and the heart rate goes up, all right? So the key here, stand up nice and firm, push your hips forward, get intense with it, set your timer for 30 to 45 seconds and work really hard. You got to push through it. Okay? There you
Love
go.
It.
3, 2, and 1. I'll show you the next one.
Okay.
Perfect. That's a kettlebell swing. More than likely, after you finish a kettlebell swing for 30 to 45 seconds, your heart rate will be skyrocket, okay? So rest for about 30 seconds, bring the heart rate down, prepare yourself for the next movement.
Right, because you got to pay back some of that oxygen debt.
You do, you do.
Yeah.
So if you see here, the kettlebell is resting right here on my forearm and on my arm, right? And what I'm gonna do is squat down, right here, and press. My other arm is my stabilizer muscle, my stabilizer arm, so that it doesn't kind of go left to right. So it's just there as a support beam. I don't necessarily need it, but as you get more confident, you can put it here, you can put it to the side. All right, you can try this. Put it right back there. Sink into the squat, point that elbow forward. Right, squat down as much as you can and press up. Yep, there you go. This is a total body exercise. Now the beauty of this is that you have that weight on one side of the body.
Yeah.
Right? So the other side of your body has to stabilize. So the heavier you go, the more the other side has to work to keep you stable. All right? It is an absolute way to engage your core, keep the body nice and challenged. All right, switch the other side.
You don't know which muscle is screaming the loudest.
You
right
don't.
Now. Your arm's going, no, it's me, it's me.
Your legs are going, I thought it was me.
Now is it right?
So turn around, put the hand in there, turn, let go. Put your hand right in there. Yep,
okay.
Rest it in here, point that elbow. The kettlebell, you can get at any store nowadays. And go ahead, and press, perfect. You can go for about a 10 pounder, 15 pounder. They go up to about 98 pounds.
No kidding.
And they get heavy. I had one mailed to my house and the mailman was angry at me. It really was. But it was so awesome. I showed him what it was. There you go, one more.
So I ordered that at about middle of March. It should arrive by April Fool's Day.
There you go. So you got the swing and then you have this squat and press. We're working the upper body and the lower body. We're working tons and tons and tons of calories. Okay, the other one, the last one, just to work the entire abdominal area. I'll demonstrate this real quick. You have a seat. You take your kettlebell. You can have your, if you don't have a weight, you can use a can of beans, anything of just a little bit of weight. Have a seat, put your legs up a little bit, and twist. I have my legs up just to give myself a challenge, but if you feel okay, and you don't want that challenge yet, keep your feet down and bring the weight all the way to the side. The more you bring it to the side, the more you challenge that, those abdominal muscles, all right? So still, challenge yourself, try, okay? And that is your Mason twist, okay? I'll help you out.
Thanks.
So you got three exercises, your kettlebell swing, your squat and press, and then your Mason twist. Absolutely great ways to burn calories, put some rest in there, and have some fun with the kettlebell. That one weight.
That one weight goes a long way.
It does go a long way, all right? So what you gotta do after that, you gotta stretch, okay?
Okay.
So let's take a nice deep breath. Inhale, and exhale. One more time, inhale. Open those lungs up, and exhale nice and slow. All right, hands down to the middle. Get a good stretch, open your hands up, get all the way down, stretch those hamstrings. Get over to the right side. 3, 2, 1, left side. Come back to the middle. Come up nice and slow, because if you come up too fast,
you'll
go down fast. All right, big circle with your neck. And you are done.
Thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
Great.
Good job.
Is a tomato a vegetable or a fruit? Well, when it comes to preventing ovarian cancer, tomatoes might be the queen of fruit. Women who eat tomatoes more than 5 times per week have a significantly lower risk of ovarian cancer than women who occasionally or never eat them. Women who regularly consumed fruit also had a lower risk, according to the Adventist Health Study. Salsa, anyone? Eating tomatoes at least 5 times a week is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for the questions you've sent by Facebook, text, phone, and email. Violet asks, I am vegetarian and I exercise twice a week, but I have asthma and use an inhaler. How can I reduce the frequency of using the steroids? Well, start by avoiding triggers as much as possible. Triggers can be include things like cigarette smoke, stress, fumes from cleaning chemicals, perfumes, air pollution, pain medications, cold and dry air, dust mites, cockroaches, mold, pets and pollen, alcohol. Exercise can also be a trigger, but you need to increase your fitness, so don't stop the exercise. Twice a week is not sufficient. Now, if exercise is a trigger for you, then you need to use your non-steroid inhaler before you start. Warm up slowly and avoid going outdoors to exercise on cold, dry days. Many people find that foods such as dairy products are the triggers for them. So do a little experimenting with your diet as well. Increase the amount of raw foods that you eat too. You might find that helps. Now, manage your stress. Don't wear perfumes or toiletries or cosmetics that contain perfume. Clean your house meticulously. Get rid of any cockroaches. And use a vacuum that has a good filter. Get special covers for your mattresses, your pillows. That will help to prevent dust mites. Get new pillows every 3 months. Clean off any mold immediately and get rid of any indoor plants because they can have mold growing in the soil. If all of those things don't make a difference, then try taking a Buteyko breathing class. Now, someone texted and said, how do I get topical progesterone cream? Well, you can buy it at a health food store, a compounding pharmacy, or with a prescription from your doctor. Benjamin called. He says, I had shingles and now I have nerve pain. What can help? Well, there are a host of medications that can be used, like antidepressants, anticonvulsants, and opioids. Those are the most commonly used things. You might want to avoid those, though, for a good reason. You can apply creams for temporary relief, such as a lidocaine local anesthetic cream or capsaicin, which is what comes out of chili peppers. It's the hot stuff. So some people find it's too hot and they can't tolerate it on their skin. Keep those questions coming. Now, let's go shopping. Corn is the most widely grown crop in the Americas, where it originated. When fresh, it's a vegetable, but when it's dried, it's a grain. Unfortunately, most of the corn grown in the US and Canada is fed to animals, making it our number one field crop. And then it's used industrially to make things like ethanol, cosmetics, ink, glue, laundry starch, medicines, and fabrics. There are many different types of corn. Sweet corn is the traditional summertime treat with its high sugar content, and that's primarily used for human consumption. Dent corn or field corn is fed to livestock, and it's used for industrial purposes. Flint corn is the decorative Indian corn that comes in a range of pretty colours. And a sub-variety of flint corn is also used to make popcorn, which is what I've got here. Most of the corn in America is genetically engineered, with the exception of flint corn. Corn is high in vitamin A, antioxidants, and carotenoids, especially those associated with eye health like lutein and zeaxanthin. Traditionally, corn's eaten with beans, and since the two have complementary proteins, that works really well to provide a meal complete in protein. In Central and South America, corn is often nixtamalized for better health. That involves soaking it in an alkaline solution like lime water. And then after draining, it's turned into masa flour. That process makes the B vitamins highly bioavailable, and it also adds some calcium. Whichever way you enjoy your corn, bon appetit. Another of the common eye disorders that Dr. Hertz mentioned at the start of the show was glaucoma. It's a bit more complex than cataracts, but ophthalmologist Dr. Hertz explains just what glaucoma is and why we get it.
Glaucoma is a gradual dying off of the optic nerve tissue, which connects the eye to the brain, so it's kind of plugs the eye in there. And it's not caused by anything that you do or don't do. It's mostly age-related, and there's a strong genetic factor, too.
So what causes that optic nerve to die off? How do you make the diagnosis of glaucoma? What goes on there?
The problem with diagnosing glaucoma is that most people don't come in with any complaints about it. There's no symptoms in the early stages of it. And so they don't know that they have it. They could be coming in just for glasses and think that that's all they need. And when you check their eyes, you check the eye pressure as well as a full dilated exam. And when you're looking at the optic nerve, if the tissue looks thinner than average, especially if there's some asymmetry between the eyes, that's a red flag that you are in the beginning stages of glaucoma.
So how common is it? How often would you, or what's the risk to someone, say, over 50 or over 60?
Well, they estimate that, at least in the United States anyway, that there's probably 2.2 million people that have been diagnosed with it and maybe another 2 million that don't know that they have it. And it is the number two cause of irreversible blindness in the world.
So how do people not realize that they're going blind?
Well, because in the beginning stages, it does chip away at the edges of your vision. And you don't see what you don't see. You don't realize that you're losing that. And your central vision remains perfect. You can be 20/20 and only have 5 degrees of tunnel vision. And you don't really notice that happening until it gets pretty severe.
And you're saying there's no symptoms?
There's no redness, no pain, no blurred vision. There's not even a pressure sensation, even though eye pressure is related to the cause and even to the treatment of glaucoma, although people can have what's called low-tension glaucoma. But if you think of the eyeball like a grape and it needs to be inflated and stay inflated in order to function properly, that average pressure should be between somewhere 10 and 22 millimeters of mercury. But if the pressure gradually goes up as you get older, and it does tend to gradually go up, then it puts some pressure on the optic nerve and on the blood supply to the optic nerve so that it gets relatively starved of oxygen and nutrients as you get older. And if there's already a genetic susceptibility, then you're at even more of a risk of getting it.
Now, you've mentioned having your annual eye checks after you're 50. So which tests are going to be picking up glaucoma? You know, if you go to an optometrist, for example, instead of an ophthalmologist, perhaps. What do you need to know that they have done to know that you've got the test done?
Well, so everybody's usually familiar with the puff of air because they hate it and it startles them.
Yes.
That is a method of checking the eye pressure. There's other methods too, but you do need to know what the eye pressure is. Most commonly, glaucoma is caused by increased eye pressure, although, like I said, there's other cases where it can be a normal eye pressure. And then the pupil needs to be dilated because you really need to have a good look at the optic nerve tissue in each eye because that's the final standard. If the optic nerve tissue doesn't look healthy, if it's not healthy, then you have glaucoma, regardless of the eye pressure reading. But you really need to check both things.
So how do you treat it?
So once you know that you've got glaucoma, then it's very treatable. It's usually one drop a day is enough to drop the eye pressure. These studies show that if you can drop it at least 20% to 30% from the untreated pressure where you were getting damage, that it should be enough to halt the progression of the disease. Problem is, most of the time people don't know they have it. But one eye drop a day is enough to fix it. And if you can treat it early, you should never lose vision from it. But if you don't know that you've got it, you can't reverse the damage once it's occurred.
Okay.
You can only halt it.
Right. And so you say one drop a day should be enough, but that sounds like you actually need to track, as a physician, you're
right,
tracking the changes in the optic nerve to tell whether you've actually won the battle?
That's right, because we think that that should be enough. But depending on the person's disease and how severe it is and how susceptible the nerve tissue is to that, we have to continue to check usually every 4 to 6 months to make sure that the nerve tissue isn't thinning out, even if we think the pressure is in a good range. And so we have multiple tests that we do to check for that.
And if you've already got tunnel vision when you get that diagnosis, you will always have tunnel vision.
Right. I can't bring back what you've lost, and that's why it's so important to screen for things like glaucoma early, because if you can catch it early and prevent the vision loss, then you can save their eyes. But if they get to you already when it's in the end stages, although you can still try to stabilize it at that point, you can't bring back what they've lost.
Dr. Hertz, there are a lot of medications that on the box it says don't use if you have glaucoma. Tell us about that.
So what that's really talking about is the narrow angle kind of glaucoma. And to explain that, it's referring to either an open or a narrow or closed angle in the eye where the drain is. And the drain of the eye is right where the colored part meets up with the white part of the eye internally. And so if that angle that's formed when those two tissues meet is a narrow angle, then that puts you at risk for that type of glaucoma, which is actually very rare. So those cough medications or cold medications tend to have antihistamines in them, could be dangerous for somebody with the narrow or the closed angle type, but the large majority of people have the open angle type, and those have no effect on people with the open angle type.
Okay. So are there different risk factors for the open angle or closed angle, narrow angle glaucoma? Or
that's a good question, because the narrow angle type is much more common in certain ethnicities and much more inherited as far as that goes. But the open angle type also has a more common finding in African Americans as well as Hispanic people. And for example, people that are 75 to 85 and African American or Hispanic, about 23% of them in the U.S. have glaucoma, versus Caucasians, who maybe 10% of them at that age have glaucoma.
So if you're an African American or Hispanic aged over 75, you have a 1 in 4 chance of having glaucoma. Often it's only found at a routine checkup, so be sure to have them. I'll see you after the break. We're back. One of my favourite websites is nutritionfacts.org, where Dr. Michael Greger creates a new 3 to 5 minute nutrition video almost every day of the year. His dry sense of humour turns boring data into hilarity, so enjoy his video entitled Dietary Prevention of Age-Related Macular Degeneration.
Anyone who's ever got a sunburn knows how damaging the UV rays and sunlight can be. Imagine what those rays are doing to the back of our eyeballs, our retinas. The eye is designed to take sunlight and focus it like a magnifying glass into the back of our eyes. Thankfully, we have a layer of cells in our eye called the retinal pigment epithelium that supports and protects our delicate retinal eyesight machinery. This layer builds up yellow plant pigments from our diet, like zeaxanthin, which absorbs blue light and protects the retina from photooxidative damage. The yellowing of our corneas when we get cataracts may actually be our body's defense mechanism to protect our retinas. In fact, when we go and surgically remove those cataracts, our risk of blindness from macular degeneration shoots up, since we've removed that protection. Instead of trading one type of vision loss for another, instead of pigmenting the front of our eye with cataracts, better to pigment the back of our eyes with diet. The pigment in the back of our eye is entirely of dietary origin, thus suggesting that the most common cause of going blind in the Western world could be delayed or even averted with appropriate dietary modification. Where in our diet do we get it? Well, the egg industry brags that eggs are a good source, but have an egg nearly every day, 6 eggs a week for 3 months, and the pigmentation in our eyes barely moves. And these were the high lutein, free-range, certified organic eggs, not purchased at the supermarket, but from a local farm. Instead of getting phytonutrients from the egg that came from the chicken, that came from the corn and blades of grass she pecked on, what about getting it from the source, a cup of corn and a half cup of spinach a day for 3 months? A dramatic boost in protective eye pigment. Just to compare to the eggs, here's the best that eggs can do. But if you cut out the middle hen and get these nutrients from plants directly, you can get up to here. What's also so neat about this study is that they went back and measured the levels 3 months after the study stopped, and the levels were still way up here. So once we build our macular pigment up with a healthy diet, our eyeballs really try to hold on to it. So even if we go on vacation and end up eating more iceberg lettuce than spinach, our eyes will hold out until we get back. Yes, eyes can increase zeaxanthin levels in the blood, but they also raise bad cholesterol levels and risk of heart disease. Therefore, an egg yolk-based dietary strategy to increase plasma zeaxanthin cannot be recommended. An alternative, cholesterol-free food source is desirable, like goji berries, for example, which have up to 60 times more zeaxanthin than eggs. A modest dose markedly increases levels in our body, an inexpensive, effective, safe, whole food strategy to increase zeaxanthin in our bloodstream. But We don't need it in our blood, we need it in our eyes. So how about a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial? To preserve eyesight in the elderly in traditional Chinese medicine, people are often prescribed 40 to 100 goji berries a day. But here they just used 15 berries a day for 3 months. But still found it could protect against loss of pigment and prevent the buildup of what's called soft drusen, which is just debris that builds up in the back of our eye, both of which are associated with age-related macular degeneration, the leading cause of legal blindness in older men and women, affecting more than 10 million Americans. Now note, they gave the berries with milk in this study, so the butterfat could increase the absorption of these carotenoid pigments. A healthier way to get the same effect would be to just eat goji berries with nuts or seeds, in other words, goji trail mix.
Goji trail mix? Yes, please. That's a scrumptious way to prevent it. So let's learn what macular degeneration is from today's guest ophthalmologist, Dr. Natasha Hertz.
Well, to understand that, you really should talk about the anatomy of the eye first. And the inside of the eye is lined with a thin layer of nerve tissue called the retina. And the very central part of that retina, which is right behind the pupil, so that's where the first things that you see are focused, is called the macula. So that specialized portion of the retina, if it starts to die off over time, is called macular degeneration.
And are there different types of macular degeneration?
There are. Dry and wet are kind of the common terms for that. It means, though, that the dry type, there isn't any bleeding involved. Whereas if it turns into the wet type, that means that there's abnormal blood vessels that have also started to grow under the macula. And those can break and bleed, and that sometimes can happen overnight. So the wet kind is much less common, but it's the worst kind to have.
Mm. So how do you treat it?
So with the dry kind, if you're in the early stages of it, the mild stages, then there's not really any medication that you can either put in the eye or eye drops or anything like that, nothing prescription-wise. But there was a big study that was done by the National Institutes of Health between 1992 and 2006, where they tried a certain formulation of high doses of antioxidants such as vitamin C and vitamin E and beta carotene, as well as some zinc, and in that formulation tested to see if that would help to slow down the progression of the dry kind. And they discovered it didn't really make much difference either in the arm of the study where they didn't have any sign of it or if they had just mild signs of it. But if they had intermediate disease, it did slow down that progression to advanced disease by about 25% over 5 years. So even though it's not a cure, it at least is something that they can slow it down with, even because there's not really anything else that you can do. I'm sorry, that's not right. If you can stop smoking too, along with the antioxidant vitamins.
All right. Now for the wet kind, if you've got bleeding, is there anything you can do? Do you laser, anything?
So for the wet kind, it used to be that they would laser the area that was bleeding to stop the bleeding, and it did stop the bleeding, at least in that area, but it also killed all the tissue in that area and left them with a big blind spot. And so some people were asking, is the treatment worse than the disease? And fortunately, 10 years ago, about 2004, they came out with a medication that if you inject it in the eye, which I know sounds terrible, but if you inject it in the eye, it will shrink those abnormal blood vessels so that if you catch them early enough, you can stop them from breaking and bleeding and taking the vision.
Mm.
And so that's really revolutionized the treatment of the wet kind.
Right. How often do those injections need to be done? Is it a once? So, it doesn't sound very pleasant.
So that is another area of improvement that they're looking to change. At this point, the medicines last about 4 to 6 weeks. And depending on the person, you know, if it keeps coming back, they have to keep doing the injections that often.
Oh, that's tough.
But because of how miraculous they are, really, people will do it. I mean, it saves their vision. I had a dear lady who only had one good eye, that the other eye that just never really worked well, even from birth. And she unfortunately one day woke up and all of a sudden her vision was gone. She came in, it was the wet kind. And she got them the treatment, the injection done within a day or two of seeing me, and she got her vision back. I mean, she's able, she's not 20/20, but she's 20/30. She's able to drive. I mean, it made a huge difference for her.
Oh, yeah, that's life changing. So what are the risk factors for macular degeneration?
Number one is still age. Number two is smoking. And then beyond that, there is also a correlation to ethnicity with macular degeneration, with it being much more common in Caucasians. And that is, especially in people that are 65 and older, although you can see the beginning signs even in 40 to 50 range.
Perhaps during your 40s, you've seen an optician for reading glasses. But once you hit 50, that's not enough when it comes to protecting our vision. Regular checkups are vital. You may have no symptoms or any family history, but remember what Dr. Hertz said, you can't see what you can't see. So find out what you can't see before it's too late. And though vision deteriorates with age, you can do many things to slow it down. Like eating plenty of veggies and berries, the more colour, the better. When it comes to fat, choose healthy fats like avocados, nuts and seeds. And whatever you do, don't smoke. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.